Welcome to Switzerland in Sound, produced and presented by Bob Zanotti.
Welcome to Switzerland in Sound and Swiss Political Roundup. I'm talking to Peter Holler, Switzerland in Sound's political correspondent and analyst. Peter, the last time we talked, we discussed a cocktail, a poupourri of various issues, and one of the most prominent was economics. And now, in the meantime, we have a situation where the Swiss franc, in the last few weeks since we spoke last, has taken such a dramatic turn. It is skyrocketing in value against key currencies, like, of course, the euro, against the U.S. dollar, against the pound sterling, and we're talking not pennies, we're talking big sums of money here. Just one example, the U.S. dollar not long ago was one that would buy you 1.20 francs. Now it's fallen below 80 Swiss centimes. The euro, you almost hit 1.50 at the beginning. Now it's down to below 1.10. The pound sterling used to buy you 12 francs. Now it's down to 1.20. We get the picture. Now, in a letter from Switzerland, which I would mention here, I took up this subject, and as I was writing, the announcement came that the Swiss National Bank had undertaken a series of measures designed to take the pressure off the franc and to lower its value against these major currencies, especially the euro. Peter, what is the essence of these measures?
Basically, the bank has taken interest levels, which were very low anyway, taken them down to practically zero. In other words, from 0.75% down to under 0.25%. Additionally, the bank is flooding the market with more liquidity. They're not starting the printing presses, but they're giving out more liquidity into the system. And together with the lower interest rates, they're hoping that this will take the bite off this terrific increase in the value of the Swiss franc, which at one time looked as if you might even have had parity with the euro.
As we speak, these measures were introduced, or at least announced, only a matter literally of minutes ago. And I've heard some preliminary discussions from experts, and the reactions are mixed. There's initial euphoria, well, euphoria is too much, delight, applause. This is great. It's long in coming. It will certainly take pressure off, but for how long? Then the negative voices, or the more critical voices, enter the scene and say, this is just not enough to really turn the situation around. What information do you have, and what is your opinion?
Well, you have to realize that the Swiss franc is a small currency in the world. And, for instance, one of Zurich University's economic professors said yesterday that whatever the Swiss National Bank does, whatever it does, is the same as pouring one cup of water into the very large Lake of Zurich. In other words, the speculation against the Swiss franc is all taking place in the world financial markets, which are all much larger than Switzerland. The Swiss National Bank has only one main duty, which is to keep prices stable in Switzerland, but the tools at hand in such a small currency is limited, and basically you could say lowering interest rates again is a sign of desperation, because the downside of lowering these interest rates yet again is that there will be even more subprime-type mortgages issued on the Swiss market.
And people are saying increased inflation. Some experts say, well, we don't really have inflation at the moment, so we can handle that, but we don't know to what extent the inflation might increase. You say it yourself. The Swiss National Bank has at least one hand tied behind its back. Wouldn't this imply that drastic changes are called for in the powers of the Swiss National Bank?
The Swiss National Bank is owned by the Swiss cantons. And the only legislation, as I said, is to keep prices stable in Switzerland. I don't think you would find anybody, or certainly no majority, in any kind of drastic change to any regulation of the Swiss bank, which also, of course, is totally independent. It's probably one of the most, if not the most independent, national bank in the world.
But that's just my point. It seems from what you've just said that the Swiss system, which is very, very slow to function and very slow to change, is just not up to this present crisis, we could almost call it.
Well, of course, you have to see that this crisis, whatever it is caused by the weakness of the euro and by the weakness of the U.S. economy, which are both factors outside any action which the Swiss National Bank can take.
Okay, so much the situation is, as we say, journalistically, is fluid. So we have said, I guess, all we can say about this. Let us turn our attention at the moment, Peter, to the upcoming elections. And suddenly, you know, the hourglass is going down, down, down. We're talking about general elections in October. And the situation is changing very, very fluidly in the economic sector, although economics and the Swiss franc don't seem to have been a major issue in the campaign, any political platform even. But there's one subject which does come up constantly, and that is immigration policy in Switzerland. As we mentioned even last time, and I don't think it's changed, even the more moderate parties, the softer liners, have come around to the thinking that the Swiss immigration policy has gone more or less out of control.
Yes, it's interesting that it's not the, in inverted commas, sleazy subject propagated by the right anymore. It's become more or less a national issue against a background when you have 22% of the resident population being aliens or foreigners, and the 22% are the official registered foreigners, and there are probably 200,000 or 300,000 illegals as well, plus at least 40,000 rejected asylum seekers who are still here after 7 years, which is the average figure. In other words, the Swiss population is now pushing the 8 million mark, which is basically a doubling since 1945. And Switzerland was never thought of as an immigration country like Canada, Australia, or the USA. But in effect, it has become that over the past years. And it has been, if you like, made more critical by Switzerland's adherence to the Schengen system of the European Union. Switzerland is not a member of the EU, but it is a member of the Schengen and Dublin agreements, which basically regulate the free movement of persons. And when the Swiss government sold this item to the Swiss voter, they said they poo-pooed any idea of an increase in immigration. But in fact, what's happened is that net immigration, just from Europe alone, officially is over 100,000 a year, which means a city the size of Zurich has accrued, again, in the past 3 years since the Schengen Agreement has come in force in Switzerland. The population pressure means that, for instance, rents have been going up in Swiss towns to the extent that the native population is now moving out to the suburbs or even to the countryside, and only the big earners, many of them from abroad, can afford a city apartment.
Now, how is this going to pan out in the general elections?
Well, for instance, the right of center Swiss People's Party says that Switzerland should renegotiate the bilateral agreements with the EU, including the Schengen Agreement. Now, whether this is possible or not, nobody really knows. The other parties say that as well as trying to modify the Schengen Agreement, there should be even more flanking arrangements to stop, for instance, wage dumping in Switzerland from workers from Eastern Europe, to stop anybody undercutting Swiss wage levels. And, I mean, this is being done up to a point with inspectors on building sites catching firms which employ people at less than union rates, etc. But, of course, this is basically a sort of sticking plaster on an old wound.
It looks like, though, the immigration issue is going to be the dominant issue. I mean, as we speak, we're, of course, a couple of months away from this at the moment. But would you agree that's going to be the turning point, the big burning issue in the elections?
Well, of course, we can see now with the Swiss franc and the economy suddenly blowing up in seriousness. Anything can happen between now and the end of October when elections are, but certainly I would say immigration is going to remain a hardy, stable issue. There are now four initiatives launched already to limit immigration. And, of course, there's no country in Europe apart from Luxembourg which has anything like the 22-23% foreign population that Switzerland has.
Peter Haller, Switzerland and Sound's political correspondent and analyst. Thank you very much.
Hi, this is Bob Zanotti. Do you miss Swiss Radio International? If so, I invite you to visit my website, SwitzerlandInSound.com. Colorful and informative radio features about Switzerland, its destinations, interesting people, politics, culture, and even the two Bobs, SwitzerlandInSound.com, where English language radio from Switzerland lives on.
There are many visitors, obviously, who come to Switzerland. This is a very popular destination for visitors from all over the world. Many, many ways to see this country. And, of course, the classic way would be by train or by boat. Switzerland has probably Europe's best organized public transport system. But, you know, there's another way to see Switzerland, and that is from the bird's eye view. No, I don't mean in a commercial airline they're flying over the country. I mean getting into a small plane or a helicopter or how about a hot air or even gas balloon, doing it that way. We have the man with all the answers how we best do that. He is Felix Kieser, who is the Secretary General of the Aero Club of Switzerland. If he doesn't know about this, then nobody does. Mr. Kieser, welcome to Switzerland in Sound. First of all, quite a basic question here. We assume that it's fairly easy to see Switzerland by small plane, helicopter, or balloon. Is that in fact the case? Is it easy to do?
Yes, a firm, as the pilots would say. We have got quite a few airfields in Switzerland, more than 40 small fields, and whether it be within the Alps or further down, we have a lot of occasions to do that.
This, of course, from a pilot's point of view, is a really, it's a challenging country with all of the mountains. We have special weather patterns here, microclimates. These pilots must be pretty good. They're pretty well trained. We're not talking about the old barnstorming pilots of years ago. These guys know what they're doing.
Yes, and we have just to demonstrate what it means. We have special ALP instruction lessons that all pilots that fly in Switzerland have to undergo, and the foreign pilots who come to Switzerland, they do first get instructions how to fly within the Alps and into the Alps in case they do not perform that in their own country.
So anyone who will take a small plane ride or a helicopter ride or a balloon, they can rest assured they're in the best possible hands.
I can assure you, yes, we are very regulated. That is certainly the case.
And of course, here in Switzerland, we have to remember that there's a militia army or air force. There's a semi-professional air force in this country. I imagine some of your membership and some of these pilots probably also are military pilots at the same time. They know the mountains. They know the terrain very well.
Exactly. That's quite the case. A lot of them come from the military, are still in the military, or the basic training was in the military.
They don't get any better. I've seen some of these guys in action. It's amazing. Also on the internet, you can see some breathtaking videos of Swiss Air Force pilots and what they do. It's absolutely incredible, and anyone interested can find that. Mr. Kieser, let's look at the flights themselves. I mean, Switzerland is a small country, but extremely diverse. If we look at the geography, can you say which are the most popular flights among visitors to this country?
Of course, to the Alps or within the Alps, but of the other places, very nice to see. But most popular, to answer your question, yes, these are the Alps. And within the Alps, it's probably the Matterhorn, the old Matterhorn, though there are many other places that are spectacular at the Matterhorn.
I can imagine around Lucerne, it would be the Pilatus, and in the Bernese Oberland, it would be the Jungfrau, and so on, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And the advantage is if you come out from here, then you all your way along to the Matterhorn. Well, if we stay with the Matterhorn, then you have a spectacular scenery all the way up there.
Is it possible, incidentally, to do mountain hopping trips, for example, to go over the mountains to neighboring Italy or perhaps to Germany or France? Is that also done?
Certainly. And one popular route is coming from here, the countryside, going to the Alps and then take a break in Sion, for example, or Geneva, and then go back. Meaning taking a break, landing at an airport there and having what we used to call the $100 hamburger in the States to go back.
A very good friend of mine was a glider pilot here in Switzerland. He did also motor gliders, and I had some wonderful times with him. It's so breathtaking, and we mustn't forget that in addition to the classic small motorized planes, also gliders are fit into this. So we talk about small motor aircraft, light aircraft, in other words. We talk about gliders, helicopters, balloons. This is quite an assortment of hardware here. Can you say, Mr. Kieser, which type of aircraft is best suited for which type of sightseeing?
Well, I would just start with a very good idea. You just mentioned that the sailplane, it's just that it's only for one person that can do it. So you cannot go together with your friends, but you have the pilot and yourself. That is really something special to glide among the mountains, as you just pointed out. Then, of course, there are the other means, the other aircrafts and balloons, the small ones, the bigger ones. From the small one that is probably the most popular, the Piper and the Cessnas and so on. But you have the small helicopters also that are more affordable than the big ones. And then you have the balloon, the hot air or even gas, which has become rare. But that is something very spectacular to do and really amazing, the balloon rides.
Well, the balloon, of course, that must be the great classic way. I mean, we go back to the grand days of the grand tour, seeing the mountains by balloon. You bring your champagne along and you sit and just look at God's country. You need some time for a balloon trip, don't you?
Exactly. You need the weather, pilot and time, and then if you talk about the old times, we have to mention the gas balloon, which has, as I said, become very rare, but also very expensive, we have to be honest.
Let's look at the cost for a moment. Does one have to see his banker first before you go on one of these trips, or is it affordable?
No, I think it's sufficient to consult your family and take it along. So we are talking from, I would say, 100 francs up, of course. If you have 100 francs for a helicopter, that will be a short jump you do. But with the four-seater small airplane, with 100 francs, you do already a 30-minute trip. Mm-hmm. But I would say from 150 francs on, you have a beautiful sight. And as far as ballooning is concerned, I would add up that to 200. But the average is for the motor aircraft. For a sightseeing into the Alps, I would say 250 or 200 to 250, about an average. With a helicopter, it adds that up to, or goes up to 350, and the balloon also around that.
Now, are these half-hour segments we're talking about or full hour?
The average one I was mentioning now, I counted an hour. That, mm-hmm. I think, is an average of a sightseeing flight.
Well, that's a pretty fair
ride
flight.
The
yeah.
balloon, yes.
Yeah, that's a good flight. Incidentally, before I forget, years and years ago, as a young reporter for the International Radio, I got an interesting assignment. You will know the name T. Rufer, one of Switzerland's most famous glacier pilots. I think he used to have a Piper Cub or something along
those
lines.
Most probably, yes.
Yeah, and he would actually land and take off on glaciers. Is this still done?
Yes.
That you can still do that?
Of course, yes. And that is really amazing to do that, yes.
Yeah.
There are not so many glacier pilots. The they demand a lot of experience. There's a lot of experience, and there are not so many glaciers again who are allowed to land on. Mm-hmm. But that is something really special.
And that's a very high specialty too. I mean, you really have to know what you're doing.
Exactly, and it's still done, yes.
Yeah.
It needs a lot of loadage and another skill.
It's getting exciting. I'd like to get one of these flights myself again. I have one last question for you, Mr. Keyser. What about private pilots who are licensed in their home countries? And they say, well, you know, that would be a great idea, but I can fly my own plane. Can they do that here?
Yes. Most pilots fly internationally, fly in other countries, so they are allowed to do that. And the international regulation has been valid for since the beginning of flying almost. There have been agreements. So that means that we can fly into and out of other countries with foreign licenses, most of the pilots. Of course, there are also licenses that only apply for the home country. Then what I would recommend to foreign pilots, if they want to do it commercially and add and make really make it attractive and go to public and announce themselves, then I would recommend they check the validity of their license and their activity with FOCA, our national regulator.
You mean if a commercial pilot wants to work as a commercial pilot here, this requires a special agreement. But an ordinary sport or private pilot, as we understand it, the classic Cessna or Tri-Pacer or Piper flyer or Mooney, he can come here with his national license and it will be recognized.
Of course, yes.
Sounds very exciting. I used to fly a lot with my father. Back where I grew up, and I understand you were there too, I grew up in New Jersey, outside New York, and you lived in Long Island on the other
side. Exactly, that's where I got my first flying lessons, and my license, by the way.
Isn't that something? It really is a small world. We used to fly out of sometimes Teterboro.
Teterboro.
When it was still a very small, quiet airport. Now it's very commercial. And then Morristown. You probably know Morristown.
Yes, of course. When you mention it now, I remember that it was part of my lessons, one of my landings. Yes.
Those were the days when you actually were allowed to fly right over Manhattan. I think that's not done anymore.
I still could do that. Yes, I still could do that.
Yeah, but
flying out of Long Island. Yes.
I think, though, you need permission and clearance before you can do that these days.
It's, of course you have. Of course, and radio communication is part of the flying.
That's right. That's right. Felix Keyser, the Secretary General of the Aero Club of Switzerland, with some expert, well-informed information for those who would like to see Switzerland from up there. On your next visit, some great ideas. We'll also have a few links for you here on the website. Mr. Keyser, thank you very much, and of course I have to wish you happy landings.
Okay, I thank you very much, and wish everybody flights over and into Switzerland.
Unforgettable it will be. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
PCJ Radio would like to make you a winner. PCJ Radio is giving away 3 Texan 920 World Band receivers to 3 lucky winners in June, July, and August. In September, we are having a grand giveaway of a brand new Sanjen ATS 909X worth $399 to 1 lucky winner. To enter, let us know how you heard this program with the date and time, and answer the following very simple question. What does radio mean to you? You can send your entries to ATS909X at gmail.com. Again, that's ATS909X at gmail.com. If you wish to enter by snail mail and receive a small thank you gift for entering, you can find our postal address at www.pcjmedia.com. Winners will be announced on a monthly basis on Media Network Plus. So, good luck!
This is the second version of this month's letter from Switzerland. After I finished the first one, news came that the Swiss National Bank had taken new steps to tackle the very serious problem of the uncontrolled rise in the value of the Swiss franc against other major currencies. More about that later. It was not that long ago that the U.S. dollar was worth 1 franc 20, and the euro would buy you nearly 150. At this moment, the dollar has fallen to below 80 Swiss centimes, and the euro has tumbled to 1 franc 10. The pound sterling checks in at a mere 1 franc 30. Experts say the pressure on the franc is due to foreign investors buying francs as a safe haven currency. While some naive nationalists may wave the flag and claim smugly that the rise of the franc is a sign of some kind of national or cultural superiority, they forget that this country lives on exports and that the tourism sector is also a major source of national and personal income. The fact is, the Swiss tourism and export sectors are panicking as the cost of Switzerland as a tourist destination skyrockets, and with exporters saying that they will soon be unable to compete on the key European market because of the high value of the franc against the euro. Before I continue, let me point out that Switzerland already figured within the top three of Europe's most expensive countries, and that was long before the current dramatic rise in the value of the Swiss franc. I wouldn't be surprised if it has now hit first place. On top of this, or perhaps we should say at the bottom of this mess, is a government which seems to have been operating from an ivory tower on some other planet. A couple of weeks ago, the Swiss Minister of Transport tabled proposals to raise public transport fares by a whopping 27%. This, she says, is to cover the cost of new infrastructure, the need for which is debatable, in a country which already boasts the most efficient public transport network in Europe, also already one of the most expensive to use. But who should pay for this gift to the construction industry and green lobbyists? The answer is the standard Swiss government notion of passing the cost on to the public. In this case, the users of public transport. And lest automobile drivers turn to their cars as a cheaper alternative, the government has their eyes on them too, with a proposal to more than double the cost of the annual highway tax. This, nota bene, would also apply to visitors to the country. There is apparently no question of the government forking up any money of its own for these grandiose plans. In other words, the government decides what's good for us, and the economy, and then sends us the bill. And then we come to the Swiss hotel and restaurant sectors, which obviously play a key role in the high cost of this country for the average visitor, and the Swiss themselves. I've personally watched as prices in classic Swiss restaurants soared in recent years. I would say they've doubled in less than 10 years. As a reference point, let's discuss fast food, which is supposed to be at the bottom of the culinary price list. A small, plain, personal cheese pizza will put you back $20 in the average Swiss pizzeria. A Big Mac and a soft drink will cost you 15. A plate of spaghetti is also now pushing the $20 mark. Salads are rarely included because they're a lucrative value-added item, not to mention alcoholic beverages, which are more often more expensive than the meal itself. As for urban hotels, you'll find them priced at the London and New York level. Hotels in the popular resorts are also no bargain basement. And let us not forget that in Switzerland, hotels charge by person and not the room. So why, you might ask, is Switzerland such an expensive country? Well, if you Google that question, you'll find some interesting answers. But they all add up to more or less the same thing: excessively high profit margins, lack of real competition, and a lack of consumer protection legislation and practices that are taken for granted in other industrialized countries. This is the traditional home of monopolies, cartels, and price fixing, and they're showing no sign of going away. Defenders of high Swiss prices cite higher salaries than in other countries. But what's the point of making more money if the cost of living is that much higher? In terms of buying power, the Swiss come relatively low on the European scale. Let's now turn to the Swiss consumer. Despite the dramatic rise in the value of the Swiss franc, which makes imports cheaper, the prices on the shelves of Swiss retail stores have remained largely unchanged. Someone's obviously making a killing in this bonanza situation, but it's definitely not the Swiss consumer, who has been trained to pay any price asked, and cheerfully does. As an indicator of the arrogance of some Swiss business people, a major supermarket chain recently criticized consumers for going to neighboring countries to shop there. They even called it disloyal. This was probably also meant as a smack against those who patronize a major German supermarket chain, which has upset the apple cart by introducing EU prices in their Swiss outlets. Thanks to them, and them alone, the big Swiss chains have been forced to lower many of their prices. On the other hand, these often turn out to be pseudo-price reductions, because while lowering the prices on some merchandise, prices are raised on others to make up the loss. With the important Swiss export and tourism sectors under threat, one would expect serious talk of measures to reduce the value of the franc, and indeed even lowering prices in real terms to get them closer in line with the foreign competition. Well, the Swiss National Bank spent 11 billion francs to buy up euros to relieve pressure on the Swiss franc. But this was a soft approach to the problem, which hasn't worked. The latest move by the SNB to lower the lending rate to practically zero, which is where it almost was before, has been widely criticized as a placebo effect, or mere window dressing. One prominent newspaper has even accused the National Bank of living in the past. I would include the government. As the dust settles, it seems apparent that the Swiss government is not willing to introduce hard measures, like heavy negative interest on foreign deposits, nor is it willing to consider linkage to the euro. God forbid. Furthermore, no one in government is talking seriously about introducing any curbs on cartels and price fixing. In short, it's business as usual, and Nero fiddles while Rome burns. It seems that many people, even in high places, believe that by ignoring the problem, it will go away. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development has repeatedly criticized Switzerland for what amounts to its antiquated economy. In an official U.S. government analysis, the Swiss economy is described as the last bastion of classic capitalism in Europe. That, by the way, was not meant as a compliment. So what will it take to wake up our political and financial leaders? It looks like only a serious economic crisis will do that. In the meantime, it's business as usual, as cynical as that sounds, and as cynical as it is. This is a general election year in Switzerland, and you would expect these issues to be the subject of heated and even emotional debate in the media. But not here. The high value of the Swiss franc and the growing threat to important sectors of the economy are virtually absent from the political agenda and the party's platforms. Yes, indeed, somebody's really out of touch and needs a reality check very badly. But in all fairness, is it the politicians, or is it the Swiss electorate who needs it more? Maybe both.
If you want more information about Switzerland in Sound, check them out online at www.switzerlandinsound.com.